Hello and welcome to Key to IP, the show where intellectual property experts take a deep dive into intangible assets and innovations, discussing recent news and trends from the world of IP. I'm your host, Ruth Skinner, and today we're going to talk about IP strategy and procedural needs with two key players at the Dana Bayer Group, Dr. Robert Fichter and Tobias Diebold. Dr. Robert Fichter, as the head of Dana Bayer & Associates, you're responsible for the strategic direction and management of all international branch offices of Dana Bayer's IP law firm. Thanks to your past assignment as one of the product owners of Dana Bayer's IP management software Dimes IQ, you've had invaluable experience as a bridge between IT and IP at Dana Bayer. What are some of the projects you are currently focusing on?
Yeah, first of all, thanks a lot, Ruth, for the invite. I'm very happy
You're
to
welcome.
Be here. And please call me Robert. Yeah, I think it's more.
Okay, thank you.
So let's focus on your question. So actually, Dana Bayer is having offices on all inhabited continents, as we usually say. That excludes currently Antarctica. But if climate warming continues like it does today, I'm pretty sure we will open an office there in the near future as well. Unfortunate, but that's how it's going to be, obviously. We're having more than 3,000 clients, and you can imagine that this requires a very dedicated and unique, specifically uniform case management approach to address all our clients' needs. We have clients who are accessing our Dimes IQ instance, so our IP management system, directly to see their records, to pull reports they need for the daily work, and do even more activities. Actually, we have already one client, and we expect in a few more to come, who even manage parts of their own portfolio in our Dimes IQ system without us adding anything else except for the software platform. And we take care of the other part of their portfolio. So to give an example here, clients do their local national portfolio themselves while we take care of the international portfolio. So that's the development we see in the industry as such, that people are tired of using pre-installed IP management systems. They're tired of discussing with their IT departments about any issues they might experience. And they're relying on service providers like Dana Bayer to access their hosted IP management system. In addition, we're focusing a lot of our energies on harmonizing processes across all participating law firms at Dana Bayer. For us, this is really essential, as we have expanded very quickly in the recent years from one office in Luxembourg, now two offices on each and every continent, as I mentioned before. So harmonized processes are paramount in our collaboration. In addition to that, we also see that we are working with business partners. It's not only the clients, it's patent offices, but it is, of course, also local associates. So we want to avoid sending emails back and forth to those business partners. We are using Dimes IQ again to facilitate this, and we believe, and we have already a case study showing this, that we can save up to 70% or even more of all email traffic on this front.
70%, that is impressive.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And if you count that down to man hours or man days, we are really speaking about entire FTEs being released of sending back and forth emails. Every email you're sending that also needs to get archived. We are a law firm, so we have to archive what we are sending to our clients, and we have to archive what we are receiving from our agents. And if all that goes, well, away, we will save a lot of working time, and we really can focus our people on high-value work and not just sending emails. But if you let me continue, there's also a new exciting project which may certainly last a few more years, and we call that our legal ecosystem. That is bringing all our services and products online, which is not really exciting in 2022, but obviously it's something everybody is working on, and there will be new and exciting services coming out, which we will only offer in a digital way. In this connection, I want to emphasize that we do have product managers among our ranks, which is quite special in law firms. Very often in law firms, you see some partners, or maybe super skilled paralegals, who have some IT knowledge and some process knowledge, and they are utilizing parts of their working time to bring up new processes, to bring up new procedures and services. At Dannemeyer, we decided to focus product management in certain functions. So we do have a couple of product managers, one taking care of trademark related aspects, another one taking care of patent related aspects. And overall, there is a main product management function taking care about the so-called legal apps ecosystem. So I think we are quite proud of this specific arrangement at Dannemeyer. And I can only tell the audience, stay tuned for updates to come in 2022 with new and exciting products and services.
Wow, thank you. This is so interesting. Tobias Diebold, Chief Commercial Officer of the Dannemeyer Group, is also joining us today. Tobias, before joining Dannemeyer, you spent 10 years in multiple management positions where you were responsible for strategy, business development, and M&A in emerging markets. How's IP been working out for you, and how much of your past experience were you able to bring to the table?
Thanks, Ruth, first of all, for the kind introduction. Yes, I joined Dannemeyer 4 years ago, and before joining Dannemeyer, I spent nearly roughly 10 years in the airline industry. So from that respect, I'm a little bit the exotic guy in Dannemeyer, because unlike of many of my highly esteemed colleagues, I don't have an IP background. So that meant, first of all, I had to climb a steep learning curve. I had to do my homework, get into the IP business and understand the business, first of all, which I think for everyone in a management position is very essential to understand, okay, what are the key drivers that define your business? What has helped me really a lot, and that's really a great thing about Dannemeyer, because of its diversity and variety and the capabilities that you have an expert really in nearly every field of IP. I mean, many science with a science background, many, many PhDs like Robert, there is really on every aspect of IP someone who can help you. And that helped me a lot in my onboarding experience. So I can always rely on those colleagues when it comes to legal details, when obviously not the in-depth expert and the complexities of all the framework that is related to IP. I mean, where I operate on that intersection where law meets business, and I think you heard from Robert that Dannemeyer is not a typical law firm, but really, yeah, has that synergies or looks at the law environment very much also from a business perspective, driving efficiencies, digital transformation, all these aspects. And here's what I try to bring to the table and where I try to help the organization is in these strategic and commercial aspects of the business, and at the end of the day, how we can help a client to succeed. Because that's really the main question to me, at least in every business. How can you create value on behalf of your clients? I mean, there's this famous saying, no customer, no business. And yes, it's true. I mean, it's a client or a customer appreciates or let's say wants to understand what value can you create on their behalf. And here the techniques are quite similar across businesses, because you need to understand the main drivers of commercial value and what solutions you can provide to the client that play into those drivers. Maybe a little bit of a concrete example here, because it's maybe sometimes a bit abstract, but the patent is really a powerful instrument because it safeguards your future cash flows. And that is obviously one of the most important aspects in every business, your future cash flows. It defines your value that you bring to the table as a business. And here, take pharma as an example. It's really vital to understand where your most important IP assets are that protect your long-term revenue streams, in particular on pharma, where you have to invest a lot of money into R&D, and you need to have those cash flows to be able to come up with the next blockbuster. And here, we can provide everything that is needed to do this, the analytical, the legal, and the consultative advice to that end, really on the intersection of where law meets business. And at the same time, and I think that's the unique positioning of Dannemeyer in a way, where we have that different capabilities. Every business, in particular, if you have large portfolios, large IP portfolios, also have your cost under control, and in particular, the cost of maintaining your portfolio. And here, in addition to this in-depth expertise, we can offer really scalable and cost-efficient concepts to manage portfolios in these cases. So I think that's, to come back to your question, this is where I try to support the organization here, looking also from a client perspective, how can we create that value on behalf of our clients, in particular where law meets business, where the strategic and commercial aspects of the business are important to create that value.
Yes, the things do actually go hand in hand, don't they, anyhow, in every business?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's never a silo or standalone approach.
No. And actually, talking about portfolios, in the last podcast, we looked at how patent renewal is vital for maintaining an IP portfolio. But how exactly does an IP portfolio come about? Are there any insider tips and tricks? Robert, could you explain to our listeners some of the strategies for building an IP portfolio from the ground up?
Yes, of course, but there is unfortunately not a single answer to this topic.
Well, that would be too easy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. No, as a lawyer, you always say, it depends.
It depends is the famous question here, right? Yeah. It's always, it depends.
So, and in this case, it depends on your underlying business strategy. So there are, to start a small lecture here, three basic strategies which we know and which are written and explained in the literature typically. That is what we call the cost leadership strategy, a differentiation strategy, and a so-called focus strategy. And all these three business strategies require individual and own IP strategies. So let's take an example here and look at the cost leadership strategy. As it will impose, or as the name imposes, it's all about being inexpensive, not being cheap necessarily, but being a low-cost producer at a certain and expected level of quality. And this strategy obviously requires saving money also on IP. Sometimes those strategy appliers even want to save so much money that their patents may become unenforceable. And I can give you an example here, which happened to me a couple of years ago. I received a call from a client who said, I want to save 50% on translation costs. And first, as a lawyer, I say, okay, what does that mean? Yeah, I cannot just ask my local agents, reduce your cost by 50%, and then we're all happy or what. But that was exactly what the client wanted. So he said, let us translate the independent claims in a good way. Ask an attorney to double check and be sure that the main claim, at least, or all the independent claims are really 100% accurately translated. For the rest, for the description, for the dependent claims, I don't care. Ask a trainee to do the translation, but just don't do a machine translation. And then I ask, of course, well, what is it about? And he says, in our industry, we are not litigating. We are just counting the piles. Who is having the higher pile of patents in certain jurisdictions? That is the guy who is winning and who will conclude a nice license agreement. But we will never use those patents to litigate. So what we're looking for is saving costs. So that is a good explanation. And as a lawyer, I can say, okay, that's a fair approach. Just send me a letter of waiver so that it's not my fault if you cannot litigate. I'm just delivering the quality you expect. And if the quality is low, I deliver that low quality. And for me, that is delivering what the client wants. So that's an important thing to consider on the cost leadership strategy. The differentiation guys, they need enforceable rights. So that's a different story here. We're not saving money. They are having products which differentiate themselves from other competitor products. And obviously, they need to protect. And they're even going into litigation. We see what we say, a certain litigation appetite in such industries, and that obviously requires investing some money into enforceable rights. On the focus strategy side, however, they are really looking for the best quality rights. That, of course, a little bit overlaps with what I said before on the litigation side, but here they really want to scare away their competitors. Because focus strategy industries, they are working in niche markets and they want to avoid, under all circumstances, that another competitor enters into that niche market. Or at least there are two or three competitors in the niche market who come along quite well with each other, but only because there is very high quality rights which you cannot circumvent, which you would infringe if you come too close. To illustrate that further, we can have a look at Europe. Obviously, because I'm based in Munich in Europe, I'm taking this as an example. But worldwide, you also find different examples here. In Europe, however, many options exist to save costs with some very innovative filing concepts, which also exist for some time, but which are often not known. For one, the European Patent Office, the EPO, they offer refund models for search fees. And if you know that you're paying like whatever, 1400 euro search fees to the European Patent Office, getting a refund of a few hundred euros is not a bad thing. If you consider filing maybe 100 patent applications a year, each application you get a refund of 800 euros. That's nice money you can use to invest into a larger portfolio if you want so. So that is one thing. We call that the search fee saving concept, so to say, which requires a base filing in Luxembourg. But details I'm happy to answer maybe in another podcast, or if the audience is interested, by sending a personal note to myself. If you're looking for high quality patents, however, I recommend really obtaining search reports from different offices, different patent offices, by filing simultaneously in front of, for example, the European Patent Office and another patent office. And of course, requesting search results or search to be conducted. This will allow you to look into different prior arts revealed by different examiners in different jurisdictions speaking different languages. I don't believe that the EPO speaking German, English, French will do the best research on this planet. No, if you look into the Asian jurisdictions where people speak Korean, Chinese, Japanese, etc., they will, alone by how the language is composed, run a totally different search. And so very often different prior art or possibly relevant references is revealed. And that brings you the opportunity to cut down your patent to really have, well, it formulated in a way that it doesn't collide with the prior art discovered. And that obviously results in high quality patents. And last but not least, we have the focus business strategy, and they require also high quality patents, of course, who really need to avoid colliding. Here, I often recommend to do intensive searches already ahead of filing. Focus in working in a niche market also has a little bit the problem of costs. Yeah, so you're dependent, for example, on providers to you who have the fees in her hands. So if you have to purchase starting materials in the chemical industry and you're working in a niche market, you have not much option to negotiate those fees down. So you have to also save a little bit money on the IP side, but at the same time, you require really litigatable rights and strong rights. So I'm suggesting to do that initial search ahead of drafting even, yeah, and for sure ahead of filing, using various techniques and technology, from Boolean search to AI-supported search, like we have here at Dannemeyer Octimine as an example.
Oh, interesting. AI is always interesting, yeah.
Yeah, that's a buzzword, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
It needs to be mentioned in a podcast like this. So no, but I'm really convinced about this AI as a supporting instrument. It will not replace the Boolean search techniques and also the common knowledge which patent examiners usually have. So specifically, I'm recommending that, for example, our US clients have us in Europe review the application prior to filing to give them a few tips how to formulate the claims that we are also going to be successful in front of the European Patent Office, not in front of the US Patent Office. That is an additional advice I'm giving, not only doing the searches prior to filing using different technologies, but also asking specialists from different jurisdictions. And obviously, when you're interested to obtain a patent in Japan, it may be smart to ask a Japanese patent attorney ahead of filing to review your US-style application to ensure that you're not colliding with any particularities in Japan. So you see, it's not a simple answer.
No, not at all.
Aspects, yeah. So that's what I wanted to contribute.
Wow, this is so interesting. And it's certainly clear there's more than one way to skin a cat, sorry, cats, regarding IP in business. But is there a best practice when it comes to ensuring your hard-won IP rights are secure the world over?
Again, it depends.
I told you, Ruth, Tony always said it depends.
Huh? Yeah.
Now, let me take patents as an example. And obviously, enforceability for most of the patent owners is what counts. The example I gave at the beginning is very specific for certain industries where they just count the numbers, but normally you want enforceable patents. So to start, a proper patent draft it needs a good fallback position or many fallback positions to cover the most likely scenarios for circumvention. And that is really an issue. You just draft out of the blue and you don't really consider what could happen during the prosecution phase or even during the phase of opposition or nullity proceedings. In addition, I'm advising that local requirements need to be taken into account. If you're looking to India, for example, patents may become unenforceable only because you fail to file accurate information as to the working status of the patent. That is what we usually name the famous working statement requirement, which is something you have to do every year, year after year. I think currently it's by end of September. You're already in the process of filing working statements for our clients. And if you do a mistake there, it's a pure formal act, but it will fall back on you. It will challenge the enforceability of your patent if you do a simple mistake in such an administrative procedure. That's incredible.
Can things change sort of like from year to year, sort of like the local requirements? Can it be different from year to year or is it generally always the same?
Well, specifically here on India, it is normally the same.
Okay.
I often say India is the better Germany because there are so many regulations that Germany is known for. But if you look into the legal system, oh, yes, there's also a lot of regulations. Many of them make a lot of sense, don't get me wrong. But it's very, very, very accurate to be delivered all this information. And that's the reason why they're not changing it year after year. They have recently changed the timing, but not the content.
Okay.
But in light of the ever-growing globalization, it's of course paramount to have strong patents in your core jurisdictions that will survive, as I mentioned, oppositions and nullity proceedings. That is the quality aspect I have mentioned before. So allow me a comment I personally have on the soon-to-be-open route of the unitary patent in Europe specifically. I believe, but it might be my personal opinion, that it's not really the best approach for high-value patents to request a unitary effect. Because what does it mean? A unitary patent gets unitarily granted, but it also gets unitarily revoked. So you will lose it in all your jurisdictions by one judgment of one court. While if you validate your European patent in, well, let's say 20 different jurisdictions, then a possible attacker in litigation proceedings needs to attack you in each and every country and not just in front of a unitary court. So I think for blockbuster patents, and we mentioned pharma industry before, it is certainly not a good solution to count on the unitary patent. Smaller industries who want to save money, think back about all these business strategies I have discussed before, those might use the unitary patent because it might save you a lot of money during maintenance, but also you save a lot of money on translations as you don't have to translate in each and every European language, as it's the case today.
Just for me, because I don't have that much of an IP brain, what would be a blockbuster patent? You mentioned pharma. What is a blockbuster patent?
Yeah, it's maybe an artificial word now, yeah, because you know blockbuster medication. So that's something which really brings you a lot of profit. Let's
speak
billions here, yeah? And that is typically you see in the pharma industry, sometimes in the pure chemical industry, if you look into oil or gas industry, for example. And it might, of course, nowadays also happen in the finance industry. If you're lucky enough to get your AI-based patent granted in certain jurisdictions covering financial aspects, for example, you might get really rich in applying this technology. That is what I define a blockbuster. And here, what counts is to have as many patents granted in different jurisdictions as possible to avoid to get a unitary revocation.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. But from what you've described, one thing is sure, no portfolio is an island in this day and age. On that note, I'd like to ask you, Tobias, how IP strategy intersects with business management. What does that relationship look like and how does it work?
It depends how well you manage it, I mean, this intersection. And I think Robert laid it out very well because you already seen how much IP strategy influences business strategy and vice versa. So I think the ones who are really let's say, knowledge in this game, know how very well how the synergies of IP and other commercial concerns have to play hand in hand. It's a crucial element of a successful business, but the IP should not be a mean in its end. It's something, in my view at least, and of course I come more from the commercial side here, it's something where your IP strategy drives your commercial strategy and vice versa. So really about the strategy, the synergies. And for me at least, if you look at it from a business strategy perspective, I think one of the most important things that every business leader, every senior manager, everyone in a leadership position has to think about is how to create a competitive advantage. It's unfortunately the downside of a market environment that there is competition. It is one thing that made us successful in an open market, which drove a lot of innovation, but of course puts a strain on every business leader because your position in a market is never static, but always relative to others. So what does it mean? I mean, it can mean if you make, for instance, a profit margin of 10%, that's great. But if all your competitors make a profit margin of 30%, you have an issue. They can invest more, they can put more money into R&D, they improve their competitive situation. So your position in a market is always relative to others. And that's, I think, something that always helped me a lot to think about our position in a market. And now where does IP come in is that IP can be really that distinguishing factor that you need to be ahead of the game that can create a competitive advantage. Again, as an example, let's take a successful brand like Coca-Cola. So to maybe have an example on the brand side, not the patent side. So as far as I know, the soft drink ingredients are a trade secret recipe. But even if one would be able to exactly match the recipe, which I guess by now is possible, I think no one would argue that you can easily replace Coca-Cola in a market on a global level. It's too powerful as a brand. It's really ingrained in the head of the consumer, of course, also with a lot of marketing power. But that brand is a competitive advantage in itself. And the same then also can be said of patents. The great thing about patents is that you can protect your technical innovation for 20 years. And what you're doing then really in reality is that you have exclusivity, an exclusive claim to that piece of technology. And come back to what Robert said, the blockbuster, if that is then something that really sells well, you have something like almost like a time-limited monopoly. And that is where IP is that can become that crucial element to create a competitive advantage and also to maintain your competitive advantage. Also in the long term, take a prominent example like the German-speaking countries have that concept of SMEs, mid-tier businesses that we call the Mittelstand. Mm-hmm. Many across the regions, and you can really, really see clusters in several regions, automotive, machinery, and so on and so forth. But the many, many hidden champions, sometimes you don't even know the names, or you might not so prominent, but they drive really the regional economy, the German economy, actually. And they're part of the success. And also the resilience, I mean, to be in the market for many, many years is having understood that value of innovation, protecting that innovation, and leveraging this as a competitive advantage on a global scale. So many of those hidden champions are active globally and they export. As you know, Germany is very much dependent on exporting goods and services, particularly goods. So they have created their competitive advantage. And here I really, I genuinely believe that IP can be a cornerstone, should be a cornerstone in every successful business model, but you really have to understand the synergies and how to create your competitive advantage. And this is where every business leader, in my view, has a powerful tool at its hand, but you have to understand how to use it. So that's why it depends.
No, but I totally agree with what you've just been saying. And undoubtedly, the closer IP strategy is to a business's core operations, the more successful both will be. Of course, that localization can change in the context of mergers and acquisitions. If I could just stay with you, Tobias, how are the involved IP strategies affected by M&A activities?
That's a good question. And M&A, of course, is a can be also an important strategy for every business leader. And M&A can be a powerful element to drive your strategy in a good way, but also in a bad way. We've seen from the news many M&A deals that really did not work out. And I think important to understand is that in the M&A deals that are successful, you have put a lot of thought in this underlying rationale. And here, to bridge the gap to IP, IP can play a critical role. So you have to do your homework, you have to build your model and how you generate incremental value before making an acquisition. I mean, you put a price tag to a target, and that's typically so-called market price. So you really have to understand, that's what I mean with this rationale, how can one and one become three, not two? That is this incremental value that you create through an acquisition. And IP can be really that, where you have like maybe complementing IP, that you're looking for certain technical capabilities that you don't have at the moment, but really complement your portfolio very well. You may want to enter new markets and you're looking for an established brand that really to drive your goods and services. So there are many aspects that can play into that. But really, that is important to find out that rationale and to model it into your business case. And as I said, IP is very often an important factor in that. There's also something, if you look at large mergers and acquisitions, for instance, I mean, they're very often looking for scale, economies of scale, which obviously also is a traditional business strategy. And here you can scale your portfolio, you can streamline your processes and portfolios to achieve those synergies. So there are many aspects, and maybe one good example of how IP is a decisive factor in an M&A transaction is actually Disney. I just finished reading the biography of Bob Iger. He was the CEO of Disney for many, many years, and I can recommend it. It's really
I was just thinking that must be really interesting, actually.
It's a fascinating book, and Bob Iger took over. I mean, Disney obviously always was a powerful brand, but what some people might not know, it was also in decline for many years. So they had really problems. Of course, super successful in certain years, and then they were struggling to, for instance, to find good content. And they were also very focused on the North American market. So one cornerstone of Bob Iger's strategy for Disney was to go into M&A. But those M&A deals, or the key element was finding and acquiring companies with high quality content. Examples were Pixar and Marvel, and they put a lot of money on the table. But really, their intellectual property of Pixar and Marvel, powerful brands, powerful intellectual property, that helped really Disney to transform its business and expand globally. Eventually, and also then to come to revenue numbers and profit numbers that they hadn't seen before. And I think that is a very good example where IP was a vital cornerstone of the M&A activities, not just to grow, but to become stronger by that. And that enabled the company's future success. So again, if you're interested in business strategies, read the biography of Bob Iger. I can only recommend it, also from an IP perspective.
I love stuff like that anyhow, everything to do with biographies and strategies. And yeah, I'll certainly put that on my list. So as you have both laid out for us, IP strategy is an integral part of any organization's operation from the very get-go. But how can an IP practitioner or a business owner be sure their strategy is optimal for their company at its current stage of development? How can procedural needs change with time? This is more going to be an open discussion. So
it's a difficult one, Ruth, but okay, allow me to maybe give you my thoughts on it. How can you be sure? I mean, that's, you know, you can never be sure in business. That is, things may change quickly. I think important is really to have that open mind and seek advice and listen to different perspectives. I mean, obviously, the procedural needs at Dannemeyer, and you see also from what Robert Olivet, we have so many people who are so knowledgeable, I mean, who keep track of all the rules and regulation across the globe. And that's certainly one thing that we can bring to the table here. But on all other aspects, and particularly also then on this intersection of legal with business, I think, yeah, you have to have those different perspectives. Seek advice. And I think what I find always stimulating here, Dannemeyer, also when I came in, what's really great is the broad range of clients. So we deal with really small businesses up to multinational corporates and see different problems, different market environments. We also service a vast array of industries. We're not focused on one industry. And that also gives us a lot of knowledge, I'd say, to understand, okay, what issues do you have in pharma, in automotive, service industries, professional services. So what we and my team want is to share those insights really with everyone who seeks advice at us, here with us, and trying to have that informed perspective and having in this conversations really a consultative approach. I think that's what it's about. No one has the answer. We said it depends, but if you stay open-minded, if you have all these different influences, it really gives you a powerful instrument to deal with business issues. And that's what I, with my team, try to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I'm just throwing stuff out here. So let's say employing a service provider who's offering scale with clients' growth, portfolio size and complexity. Do you have anything to say about that, Robert, Tobias?
Yeah, I can jump in here. As I'm with Dennemeyer since 2008, actually. At that time, there were many arms of Dennemeyer not yet fully developed. For example, the law firm, that was only in Luxembourg, and we had a few clients. And now, as I said, we are like in 12 different countries having a couple of thousands of clients. So the growth was paramount. But why was it so? Because we could use the other arms of Dennemeyer to do a comprehensive offering to the clients. Let me give you an example on the software side. Many of our clients are using the Dennemeyer IP management system, Diamonds IQ, but also our legal services. And in addition, they're using our docketing services. And then, of course, they're using the annuity and renewal services to get their portfolio maintained and renewed. And if they move their offices, they're using our recordal services and so on and so on. What is the advantage of using one source to do all these activities? That is simply continuity. So we are speaking about legal rights. We are speaking about monopolies granted by the government to the patent or trademark owners, yeah, or design owners. And this is something you cannot just do as a side business and jump from one provider to another only because the other provider is like 5% less expensive than the previous one. If you go to a litigation procedure and you have switched law firms just before, you might lose some information. There's always something to be read between the lines in the head of the attorney handling your case during prosecution, which you might need in the litigation procedure. And if you change your law firm, that's it. You have no access to that previous guy who prosecuted your case. So I think using a service provider who has those different services, comprehensive services, being on the market for a long period of time, offering this continuity, and of course, having also the capabilities to give you benchmarks, to give you consultancy in different aspects, is paramount for a client. On the IT side, if I can give that example here on Diamonds IQ, we are hosting groups of different users. So there's maybe a customer meeting in France where all the big French customers from the fashion industry, but also from petrochemical industry or others, are gathering and are exchanging their thoughts and their wishes on the Diamonds IQ, of course, but also exchanging best practices on the software. And I think this is coming back maybe also to your first question. It's about benchmarking. And that is why we have LinkedIn. This is why we have WriteUp. This is why we have other platforms where people are gathering and discussing about best practices.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my input here.
Wow. Tobias, do you have anything to add?
I think there's nothing more to add from my side.
No.
Robert laid it out very well.
Exactly. I was thinking the same, yeah.
I could only reiterate again, yeah.
Well, things rarely stand still in the world of IP, and the same applies to our podcast. It's almost time for us to wrap things up for this episode, but before we do, there's just time for our trademark fun question. So, you are both very experienced and knowledgeable specialists in your fields, but what type of intellectual property asset best describes your personality and why? Robert, up to you.
Yeah, I choose the design right, actually. And this is for a few reasons. First of all, it's very often neglected by our clients. So let me use this occasion here to really bring designs back into people's mind. They're always thinking about patents, utility models, trademarks, and maybe something about copyrights, but they always forget about designs. And you see that on the filing statistics. And in addition, from a personal perspective, I'm a quite visually creative person. So recently I've started doing some NFTs, these famous non-fungible tokens. And since 1990, I'm doing video productions. And that all comes somehow along with designs. So I think that describes my personality best.
Wow. Okay. Tobias?
That's a tough one for me now, but I think I've started my career after my studies in the advertisement industry, actually. So that's where I come from at the very early stage of my career. And I'm also responsible here at Denimaya for the marketing. So I guess the best IP asset that describes me is a trademark. I'm a brand person. I'm a non-technical brand person. That's what describes me best.
Well, thank you, Robert and Tobias, for a fascinating discussion and some pretty original answers. Don't forget to check out go.denemeyer.com/key to IP, where you can also discover more about our guests today and find out about our upcoming podcast topics. Join us next time on your industry-trusted IP podcast, Key to IP. Robert, Tobias, thank you so much. It was a joy having you here today.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Ruth. You were a great host.
Thank you so much.